Hello, everybody, and welcome to Coast to Cast, a podcast on coastal science where we meet scientists and ask questions that don't usually appear in published papers. My name is Giovanni Coco, and today I'm here with Professor Ed Thornton. And yes, you heard the correct name. We finally have Ed Thornton here with us. Thornton is one of the fathers of nearshore science. Yes, some of the most influential papers, and yes, papers that have shaped our thinking in terms of wave height, the transformation, distribution, swash. And I'm sure all the listeners have read quite a few papers from Thornton. He has also worked on rip currents, on ripples, on the effects of sandbed mining. I guess anything we want to mention, Ed Thornton has worked on. There is little doubt about that. I had the privilege and pleasure to meet Ed Thornton. It was probably about 25 years ago. And I was a young PhD student. And all of a sudden, I found myself in a room during a workshop, a small workshop. I think it was funded by the Office of Naval Research. And it was the very first time that I was meeting at Thornton, and I gave a presentation in front of six people. And at Thornton, at the end of the presentation, nodded and during lunch told me, "Well done." And I thought, this is it. I made it. Anyway, it's really a great honor to have Ed here. Hello, Ed. Welcome to Coast to Cast, and thanks for taking the time to join us and answer some questions.
Well, thank you for that intro. Appreciate it.
Okay, it was actually a small intro, and I would like to start with the first question, asking you, how did you actually start in coastal science, and do you want to tell us how your career evolved, and why are you now in Monterey?
Okay, well, I'd like to put my career in perspective a little bit for the audience, that I'm in the winter of my career. I'm 84 years old, and I'd like to take a little bit of time to describe what I'd call my amazing career for the younger scientists. Now, younger scientists include everybody, because I'm about the last guy standing, okay? And much of my career was serendipitous. I calculate my career has extended over about five overlapping generations of scientists during a time to the revolutionary time in terms of instrumentation and computer power. So, but to answer your question, my interest in the ocean started when I was a mechanical engineering student at Stanford, and we had a class project to design a remote vehicle to go down to 3,000 meters and measure what's happening there with a one foot cubic payload. And in the process of doing that, I had to study about the ocean, and I won a prize for doing it. So that stimulated my interest in the ocean. That was my undergraduate. My next stop was Oregon State University, where they had both an ME mechanical engineering program and oceanography. And that's where I really started combining engineering and oceanography. And when I graduated there, I went to work for a very small consulting company down in San Diego, La Jolla, to be exact, where I started doing nearshore oceanography. And about a year of doing that, I was invited to take a research position at the University of Florida as a research scientist. Now, this was truly an amazing opportunity. At that time, this is in 1965, Per Broom, who's an old Danish, one of the original engineers, was a chairman. Jurian Batches was a student there or a visitor there. So Jurian and my career were both the same age, has overlapped all this time, and we're really good friends. So that's an amazing coincidence. But shortly thereafter, Bob Dean became the chairman, and that was really amazing for me because he's truly one of the great teachers and one of the great leaders, of the community. That's where I started, but the opportunity at the University of Florida, I took over a funded research program to do field work, and listen to this, to do field work to measure a longshore transport in the field. Now, nobody was doing this, and they had some field facilities already started, and this was the very, very, very beginning of using more sophisticated electronics, and computer power was in its infancy, and we just gotten off like PDP-11s, which you'll never know what that is, but they had the first IBM mainframes with, cards, boxes of cards, Fortran, and all this good stuff. But so I was the very first to implement an electromagnetic current meter. Now, it wasn't a Marsh McBurney, it was a flow-through version that was adapted from medical use to measure blood flow. And so that was, and I had current meters, that current meter plus pressure sensors and FM tape recorders and all this very, very crude instrumentation. But and we had some mechanical ways to measure sediment transport. So this is off a pier, and that's how I started. I will say my career was like in the Goldilocks time for investigations and nearshore studies on sandy beaches at a time when there was plentiful funding, amazingly, and the science was brand new. My opportunity really to be able to do something new, and it was an exciting time for me. To put it in sort of temporal perspective, I was born in 1939. I like to say I was born in the 30s. And 3 years later, they had these experiments to plan for the invasion of Normandy and the Pacific Islands by amphibious landings. And these experiments were done by Bob Weigel, Joe Johnson at University of Berkeley, California, University of California, Berkeley, and by Walter Monk and others down at Scripps. And this was really what I'd call the modern basis, the very start of modern studies of nearshore hydrodynamics. So that was the time, and then so I got to know all these people. I was young enough to, well, I'm old enough to know these people. And then the second generation, I would say, with the leaders were Bob Dean in Florida and Doug Inman at Scripps, and who I got to interact very strongly with both. And I was Bob Dean's first PhD student. It was a real honor. Another student there was Tony Dalrymple. Tony was the fourth PhD student. So it was, and there were a lot of good people. And Bob would have all kinds of visitors. So I got to know all these old timers. And he introduced me to, lots of scientists. And so I had a, it was just a really good time for me to take advantage of. Now, the thing is, Bob is not a field guy, he's just a super teacher. So I was truly on my own as an independent researcher. So I pretty much learned how to be a field guy by myself. It's not necessarily the best way, but that's sort of my forte and how I got started.
Said you witnessed five generations.
Yeah, I'd call that, and I'd say a generation is like 10 to 20 years. But you get out of, you graduate, you have a postdoc, you start your professorship, this is in academia, and then you have your first graduate student, and he graduates, and then that's starting the next generation. So that process is like 10 to 15 or maybe even 20 years. My career now is extending over 50 years. So I've been around a long time. So is that right? Coming up to 60 years. How is that? So that was what I'd call the second generation. And I was hired at the Naval Postgraduate School in 1969. I graduated from University of Florida. And I stayed here all that time and had just a truly, truly amazing career.
You also were leading that incredible group of scientists at some point. That was a Monterey, E.D. Gallagher, other engineers,
Oh yeah, I had a
Fabrice
super group.
Ardoin.
Yeah. But before that happened, my next big break came in 1977 when I was invited to be a PI along with Doug Inman and Bob Dean and Dick Sternberg on a national sediment transport study, which was funded at an incredible amount of over $1 million for 4 years. At that time, that was an unheard amount of money. And the objective was to improve the CERC formula for sediment transport. That was the whole objective. And so we had this first experiment down in San Diego at Torrey Pines. And I did meet this skinny, young, brand new Scripps professor with a beard and long hair, sort of like baby you, but it was heavy gray in it. And this was Bob Guza, who was a super theoretician, a lab guy, never did field work. So he was my first mentoree, and which he'll admit to, he was very, very green and raw. But he's a very quick learner, and of course he became a super field guy. And Bob will tell you that this set of experiments, which were all our earlier papers on ocean dynamics, waves and edge waves and wave transformation, longshore currents, all came out of experiments, Torrey Pines and Santa Barbara. And he said that made his career, as it did mine. It got a big, big boost early on. That was serendipitous. I just didn't expect that. But so then it followed by a bunch of East Coast experiments at Duck, one after the other, where I met Abby Salinger and Rob Holman, and that was followed on by more experiments down in San Diego. So, and then the big advance, there was always this really strong tension between the modelers and the field guides. At that time, the modelers wanted the data, and the field guides said, well, great, let's collaborate. What do we get? The answer was nothing. We'll put you in the acknowledgments. And that took about, we had a big international meeting where it didn't last long and so sort of broke up and without resolution, but it was resolved in about 4 years. And with a big push from Office of Naval Research, bringing in the Dutch models, that helped a lot. And that's really important because without one or the other, you just don't get very far. So that's sort of bringing it up to date. I had the advantage of meeting all the babies, one after another. Bob Guza was the first. You were one along the way. You were, you know, graduates. Babies are graduate students or first year professors, something like that. Just one after the other. It was really fun meeting, you know, young scientists and meetings and talking to them. Maybe a great advantage to finding really great postdocs. And that's what I did. Most fun of all was string of postdocs I had.
You mentioned the tension between field people and modelers. More in general, how do you see the science community, in the nearshore science community, how do you see it has changed? Has it changed over the last 50 years?
So now when we have a field experiment, a big program, part of that program are modelers. They're embedded in the program. And so that when you do that, and let me say most collaborations, there's always a little bit of a tension about how you're going to publish stuff and who's going to be first author and things like that, and protecting the graduate students, which is most important. And it always seemed to work out. But the modelers and the field guys are different communities. But the funding agency forced us to collaborate, for one thing. They forced the data to become available. And the modelers became more aware of what was needed, what was required in terms of fieldwork. And now we do it together. And that works super well. So I'm right now involved in two big projects, science projects, and we have almost half the people are modelers and half are field people. And so everything's just tied together. It works very well.
Okay, so in this podcast, we don't only speak about science. We also want to know something more about you. So for example, what are your interests out of work?
Okay, well, for my whole career, there was always one day a week, well, an afternoon at least, where I wasn't going to be, everybody knew, don't have a meeting, Friday afternoons, golf time. Okay, so you're maybe not a golfer, but some of your listeners may be, and they'll recognize the Monterey Peninsula as a true golf mecca. We have, well, I think, five courses that are in the top 100 courses in the world, and probably top 20. So this is there's 33 golf courses in a very small area. So this golf has been a big part of my life.
Who are the best golfers in the near shore?
Well, I may be one of them because they're not very Holman was. Holman, yes. Holman and I would play golf together. Not too many that I'm aware of. There's some oceanographers, but this is a wonderful area for hiking. You may have heard of Big Sur, which is down the coast. It's, you know, 25 kilometers away. And there's all kinds of other hiking areas here. And so hiking is something we like to do. Did lots of camping till about 2 years ago, and my girlfriend says, that's it, no more sleeping in a tent, I'm done. She's 84 also, and so getting in out of the tent at night to go pee is too hard. That's a problem. So but we still hike, enjoy doing that. And I'm also still have environmental fights I'm still doing. Those are some of my interests. Certainly enjoying life, I will say that.
What about, there is a question that I'm actually very curious to hear the answer, and is, what's your favorite nearshore paper?
Which paper did I think was my best paper, which was Thornton and Guza papers on wave transformation and longshore currents. Yeah. Those are, and that was the basis of the Navy model for predicting wave for amphibious landing. and they still use it. And I still use it. I still use
Oh, we all use it.
I wouldn't say that's, you know, best paper. I have to think about it. I like some of the papers about edgeways.
There's something really special about those papers, I think. And it's that they contain the lab, observation, theory. It was the full story. It was not chopped up in little pieces the way we tend to do today so that we increase the number of publications.
Yes, you got that right. the fun for me was being able to do some simple model. I don't claim to be a modeler, but do something simple to describe the data, and certainly to do the field work was always the most fun. I always like to tell people, if you want a career, you want to have fun, be a field guy or girl, because you're going to have fun and you're going to meet a lot of people that are a lot of fun.
So modelers nowadays are quite busy trying to predict the future. And when I say the future, the horizon is usually 2100. What do you think about those efforts trying to predict coastal morphodynamic change over such long time scale? Do you believe those models?
Okay. Well, I'm going to tell you, I have a predictive model that goes out to 100 years and the morphology that I'm studying right now, rocky shoreline, they don't change. We can talk about that later. But that's a hard one. I think that, you know, a lot of the big hope for improvements in science in general is going to be on big data. I really think that's going to be big improvements. But the problem with predicting, you know, geomorphology out to 100 years is the big data doesn't have climate change in it. That's a deficiency in making any ocean prediction using big data sets that we have, because it's old data. That's by definition.
So we will almost, in 50 years, we will be better simply because we will have seen 50 years of climate change, sea level rise, and so we will know better.
Well, that would certainly know some things better. Yeah, you know, I'm on a committee of a student that acquired a huge amount of data on wind stress and using buoys. These are stable buoys with an anemometer on top of them that I designed. That was my point. But she acquired a huge amount of data to make improvement machine learning, which is called a new technique that was borrowed from medicine, called Gaussian process methods, and has made some real progress. So I think that is a big something we're going to see more and more of, and a bigger emphasis in the future.
So you believe in the power of machine learning and all those algorithms stemming from artificial intelligence?
Well, we've been doing machine learning for a very long time. We used to call them lookup tables, okay? So it's not new, okay? Some of the algorithms are getting better, though. And I think it's the algorithm improvements. This Gaussian process is essentially a linear correlation using some assumptions on the distributions. And it's fairly complicated, but there's enormous improvements that can be made in this whole area. So I have big hope, but you have to have big data sets. And there's an enormous amount of data that we haven't mined yet or put in a framework to share. So I see that a big effort.
You mentioned earlier on a number of glorious and very famous field experiments. Do you want to tell us about any crazy story that happened during one of those big experiments?
Well, it was probably the second big experiment at Santa Barbara. And we put out all these Marsh McBurney electromagnetic current meters, which are put in poles. and then they'd stick up off the bottom about mid depth, about a meter, a half meter. And the problem with California in general is that we have Macrocystis kelp, which is the fastest growing plant on Earth, and it generally grows on rocky bottoms, and in big storms, it breaks off, and it comes to shore in big masses. And if you have a current meter or you have a pole that can catch these, they'll wrap around and break it off. So during this experiment at Santa Barbara, the kelp actually grew in the sand because it's the climate allowed that to happen. So we started having kelp come in. So we had to go out and maintain the current meters all the time at low tide. Now, low tide doesn't always occur in the daytime. Okay. So you go out at nighttime. Bob and I went out, and we could hear the roar of the surf. You're out there with a flashlight. I don't think we even had, the lights you put on your forehead at that time. I know we didn't. It was just a flashlight. One of us would hold a flashlight, and the other one would have a compass and a level and trying to align them and get them all cleaned off. And what you'd hear is this roar coming in back of you. And to be able to do this correctly, you had to put your back to the waves so you could sort of shield it. And you could hear this roar, and you didn't want to have this wave break on you, because you're going to get stabbed by this current wave. So that was probably one of the really memorable times I had, doing stuff in the field. I had lots and lots of good stories, but that was one I can certainly come to my memory.
So from what you're seeing around, can you predict a major advance that will occur in the next 10, 20 years, a major breakthrough? Do you think we will get better, I don't know, at sediment transport? We will fix the longshore sediment transport formula? Or
okay, well, there's, if you think about some obvious empirical formulas that are out there that really haven't been amenable to much improvements. One would be the sediment transport formula, which is largely empirical, or gross transport. Another one is wave forces on structures. That hasn't, these are really old formulas that are about my age almost, which makes them really old. Anything that's empirical is amenable to improvement by some of these machine learning techniques. And that's the experience I have with this graduate student on wind stress, which is solely an empirical formula that was done for deep water, and now she's improving for shallow water and really making significant progress through this machine learning techniques. Otherwise it's just really too hard a problem. And it's been a really good experience to see the power of it. And it just started. She's one of the very first to implement it for the ocean. There's two other papers that have been done for deep water. So I think that's going to be a revolution in terms of looking at some. But you need more data, or you need to get the data so you can do things like that in good shape.
So a bit of a strange question now. What would you say to your former self?
Well, looking back on my career, I would say, I wish I had done a postdoc. Okay, I came out of school with some debt and two little baby children as a graduate student, which made my ability to have a postdoc more difficult. So I never had a postdoc. And the other thing I never had was a mentor. And I think both of those advice to young people is postdoc, a good postdoc, not all postdocs are good, but a good postdoc is extremely beneficial. And having a mentor is really important. And I had the advantage of being a mentor for a large number of people. And it was a very good experience for me. And I think that was a good experience for them. So those are, looking back in a couple of things. Right now, I retired, but I didn't retire. I had fortunate circumstance that my former postdoc, Jamie McMahon, went away, and then we needed somebody to replace me. And we weren't looking for the best. We weren't looking to replace me per se. We were looking for the best oceanographer. So we had 40 really good applicants, got it down to 5, and Jamie was selected, which turned out to be much better than any of us I thought, because he's a super teacher, one of the most fun guys to be around. He was one of the bigger imaginations, amazingly. And so he came in, he took my big office. When my big office went all the crapola, you know, all the hard stuff, the teaching and admin. And I took the postdoc office. So I'm the postdoc of his. And we've had this amazing collaboration. And I'm a bit of a therapist for him because he has to deal with all the crapola I didn't do, I'm not doing. So it's been, I've had a, you know, not only an amazing career, but an amazing retirement because I'm not retired. Science is way too much fun.
Science is way too much fun. I agree. Now, for questions that have nothing to do with science, tell us about your favorite band, music, composer.
I don't have favorites per se. We listen to all kinds of music. We have season tickets to the symphony, so we like classical music. I was going to say Mozart. We also go to jazz concerts, because we really like jazz, and they have, you know, Monterey Jazz Festival, and they have a big jazz group up in San Francisco, and we like to dance to rock and roll.
Oh,
so we do it all. And there's lots of opportunities to, you know, dance to more popular music today. So pretty much like all music.
What about your favorite dish? Or do you cook and have a signature dish?
So when I retired, well, actually, I was invited to Edie Gallagher's Thanksgiving dinner back in, I think it was New Jersey, about 17 years ago. And her husband cooked this amazing dish of French stew, bean stew. Starts with a C. What's the name of it? Anyway, so it was so good that I asked for the recipe, and I started cooking. And that's when I started cooking after I retired. And my girlfriend Giselle and I share cooking, and I do a lot of cooking. So, and then the whole gamut. I like Thai cooking. One of my favorite Penang Thai curry. She does a lot of French cooking. She's French, and but I like, you know, Mexican, whatever. So enjoy cooking.
What's the latest book you read?
Sapiens, the Harari. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I don't know.
If you have not read it, read it.
Okay.
It's about all of mankind, and his prose is amazing. One of the very best writers, per se. If you want to practice your writing, read the way he writes. It's straightforward. It's just so well written. He's written two other books, and these are very well received. And they're just, it starts at the beginning of mankind and goes up to today. But it just, it looks at the evolution of man, and it's an amazing book. Recommend it highly.
And do you have a favorite movie?
Good Will Hunting.
Oh,
Matt
that's a good one. That's a good one.
Damon and Minnie Driver and others. That's a movie I could watch more than once. Yeah, that's probably my favorite all-time movie. I like movies with happy endings. Those are usually American movies. Giselle is French, and when they watch French movies, they always die in the end. So I prefer American movies, but it's just an aside.
Okay, we're approaching the end of this wonderful chat. Is there anything you want to tell our listeners before we wrap up?
Well, I'd like to thank all my amazing postdocs, Edie and Audrey Ayers and Tom Lippman and Nick Dodd and most of all Jamie right now. We went on and they overlapped because Edie stayed on because her husband had a postdoc. And so we still communicate, all of us. And for a while, it was a get together at Thanksgiving. And an amazing group and an amazing amount of fun. I guess that's how I'd characterize my career. Fun.
I
Still
think
have
your
it.
career was definitely a lot of fun and a lot of science.
Yeah.
Okay, Ed, thank you very much for joining us on Coast to Cast.
Thank you. I was pushed to do this by several people. Steve Algar and Reggie Beach both had watched you, and he, oh, you got to do this, you got to do this. So
We've
thank you very
done
much.
it. We've done it. Thank you very much, and thanks to all the listeners. Bye.